Lecture 82, The New World Order.
We left off last time at the end of the Reagan era. In early 1989, George Bush I was inaugurated as the new president, having been Reagan's vice president. 1989 turned out to be the year, one of the great years of the 20th century, one of the most important turning points, in that it signaled the beginning of the end of the Cold War. Pressure of the arms race in the 1980s and military failure in Afghanistan combined to bring the great post-war Soviet empire to an end that year. Joyful students demolished the Berlin Wall. And 2 years later, the Soviet Union itself went through a peaceful transition to democracy and survived an attempted counter-coup. These sudden changes left the United States as the world's one great superpower, able to preside over the creation of numerous new nations with more or less democratic and more or less American-inspired political systems. President George Bush I announced that America would continue to monitor what he described as the New World Order. Its first challenge was to repel an Iraqi invasion of Kuwait, a challenge to which the United States, leading UN forces, rose in 1991. The decade of the 1990s showed that the absence of communist repression permitted old ethnic and religious animosities in Eastern Europe to resurface. Hideous ethnic cleansing campaigns there led to the mass extermination of civilians. But America was reluctant to become too deeply involved from fear that Bosnia, for example, might become another Vietnam. A more elusive threat from foreign and domestic terrorism troubled the 1990s. First of all, let's look at the end of the Soviet empire. The first thing to be struck by is how much it took the Americans by surprise. All the way through the Cold War era, enormous numbers of people had been professionally dedicated to monitoring what was happening in the Soviet Union. The CIA had its analysts, the Soviet studies departments in all the universities, the military experts, the satellites. There was an enormous amount of surveillance and study of the Soviet Union. And yet, in 1986, 87, and 88, nobody was saying, it's all about to come to an end. It took everybody by surprise. The conventional wisdom, after all, was this. Russia was in a hopeless mess, and yet it was able to defeat Napoleon. Russia was in a hopeless mess, and yet it was able to beat Hitler. The fact that in all kinds of ways it's in internal disarray doesn't necessarily mean that the regime is going to fall. Somehow, always previously, they found a way to keep afloat. Maybe it will happen again. Well, in fact, an unwinnable war in Afghanistan had intensified hatred for the Soviet regime, especially among the non-Russian nationalities inside the Soviet Union, and particularly the peoples of Eastern Europe. American-Soviet relations began to improve at the very end of the Reagan years with an intermediate nuclear weapons agreement of 1987, and finally Soviet withdrawal from Afghanistan in 1988. But by then, it was already too late for the Soviet regime to survive. Its leader, Mikhail Gorbachev, was undertaking two new policies, perestroika and glasnost, one of them designed to open up access to information and to make it a less repressive information society, and the other designed to create new economic incentives rather than relying entirely upon the command economy, which the Soviet Union had followed ever since the revolution back in 1917. But although these policies were both striking departures from the long Soviet tradition, nevertheless, they were too little and too late. The question of information was perhaps particularly important. The Soviet government had depended upon monopolizing access to information. But with the development of more and more new information technologies, that was harder and harder to manage. Miniaturized tape recorders were spreading throughout the world, and many of them were getting behind the Iron Curtain. Xerox machines were becoming plentiful. Polaroid cameras, personal computers. The information technology revolution made it more and more difficult for the regime to have sole control of all of the information. You can think about the famous Soviet author Solzhenitsyn, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, one of the great Russian writers of the Cold War period. When he wrote The Gulag Archipelago, which is one of the greatest indictments of Soviet tyranny, copies of it had to pass from hand to hand in samizdat, that is typewritten copies or grainy carbon copies made on a typewriter. It was very, very difficult to make more than one or two copies of a book. Of course, once you've got Xerox machines and once you've got high-speed computer printers, it's far easier to churn out hundreds of copies, and more information within the Soviet Union was getting beyond the reach of the regime itself. Inside the Soviet Empire, there was unrest, particularly in Poland. In 1978, the new Pope, John Paul II, was a Polish cardinal. And he was the spiritual godfather of the Solidarity movement. It began as a dockyard workers' movement in Gdansk, but became a nationwide movement of opposition to Soviet oppression of Poland. Finally, the Iron Curtain itself collapsed in 1989. By then, the Russians had withdrawn from Afghanistan as more and more troops deserted and as their regime began to break up from within. Gorbachev announced that from now on, the European nations could decide on their own future rather than having it dictated from Moscow. Poland chose a non-communist government the following summer. Hungary and East Germany began to open borders which had been kept hermetically sealed for the previous 20 or 30 years. The most famous section of the Iron Curtain was the Berlin Wall, and it had been a symbol of the Cold War confrontation ever since 1961. I mentioned in an earlier lecture that after the Second World War, Berlin, although it was well inside East German territory, nevertheless had been divided into a Western and an Eastern zone. And so from the Soviets' point of view, it had always been, it had always looked like a Western espionage point deep inside their territory. And certainly the American troops there had been the kind of tripwire over which a Soviet invasion of Europe would have had to tread to inaugurate conflict. It was there that the Berlin airlift had prevented the Russians from absorbing it into their zone in 1948. And it was there that President Kennedy had made his famous speech, "Ich bin ein Berliner, I am a citizen of Berlin." Well, in 89, dancing and cheering crowds were on the wall, demolishing it bit by bit with sledgehammers in a wonderful, exhilarated party atmosphere. By now, incidentally, when you go to Berlin, it's almost imperceptible. There's just a double line of cobbles in the streets to trace the line where it had gone. But now commerce flows back and forth between the two old zones with no interference at all. And the Brandenburg Gate, which had become a symbol of division, is now the vibrant centre of Berlin once more. President George Bush welcomed the birth of democracy in Russia and in its satellites in Eastern Europe, and was careful to avoid gloating. It might have been possible to organize victory parades in America and say, here we are, the victors of the Cold War. Bush was much too sensible to do that, and instead at once began to look for ways that the Americans could contribute to shoring up democracy inside the former Soviet Union. Supporters of Reagan over the preceding decade said it was Reagan who played the vital role in bringing the Cold War to an end by ratcheting up the arms race, by bringing more and more American weapons to bear, and by developing new generations of them. He put an unbearable competitive stress on the Soviet Union, and it finally cracked under the strain because its economy was so inefficient and they just couldn't manage it. The only real sour note of 1989 was that Chinese efforts at democratization were thwarted. Great demonstrations took place in Beijing, in Tiananmen Square. And among the symbols carried by student demonstrators was a copy of the Statue of Liberty, suggesting that in China, too, American democracy was an inspiring ideal. But in China, government repression continued to work. The regime was much stronger and hadn't been weakened by warfare. The American government's response to Tiananmen Square was ambiguous. On the one hand, the American government certainly wanted democratization to take place in China as it was doing in Russia and Eastern Europe. But on the other hand, the American government also wanted stronger trade relations with China and was reluctant to intervene in internal Chinese affairs from fear that that might poison economic relations. The result was that the demonstrations and the uprisings in China failed, were severely repressed, and China remained one of the world's most repressive states into the 1990s. Even so, the events of 1989 through 91 were amazing things, an astonishing experience to live through. Generations of people by then had grown up with the Cold War, which had seemed absolutely a permanently fixed part of life. The idea that it might ever go away had almost vanished from view, and to suddenly find it not there anymore was exhilarating. The constant grinding background threat of global nuclear war also seemed to have gone. And from the American point of view, it was ideal because America was left unweakened and now in clearly an unchallengeable position. 1989 through 91 was one of those moments where suddenly everything very rapidly seems different. And I mentioned earlier that 1917 had been such an occasion, as had the period 1939 to 41, and perhaps 45 to 46 as well. Perhaps one of the most heartening aspects of it all was the demonstration that the long nuclear standoff had not ended in a nuclear exchange. Deterrence theory had worked. Of course, the thing about deterrence, skeptics had always said, yeah, the great thing about deterrence is that it works until it doesn't. In other words, you won't know if it's failed until it's already too late. But here we are, the Cold War came to an end without this catastrophic exchange, which had always been feared as a possibility. Now, the first test of the new alignment of the geopolitical alignment of the world came very quickly in 1990 and 91, when the Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein invaded his oil-rich neighbor Kuwait to the south. Iraq had been involved in a long and bloody war against Iran, America's great enemy of the late 70s and early 80s, all through the 1980s. And it had then seemed like a reasonable American policy interest to supply the Iraqi army with munitions on the basis that my enemy's enemy is my friend. Well, Kuwait provided about 20% of America's imported oil and therefore had a strategic significance for the United States. And besides, the Bush administration took this view. Now that the Cold War has ended, we've got to establish the principle that medium-sized nations aren't going to be permitted to tyrannize over their small neighbors. Therefore, we can set a benign precedent by intervening decisively here to make sure that that minor wars don't break out all over the world with new aspirants to small empires. At first, the United Nations, with strong American leadership, imposed trade sanctions against Iraq. But when they yielded no result, the United Nations forces, led by the Americans, began air raids on January the 15th, 1991. When Hussein still refused to evacuate Kuwait, a ground force invasion of Kuwait followed, and of Iraq itself, on February the 24th of 1991. Very rapidly, the Iraqi invaders of Kuwait were repelled, and the war ended with total victory for the United Nations forces, not surprisingly, because the overwhelming preponderance of force was on their side. The Americans, for the first time, used smart bombs, that is, radar-guided bombs, which could seek out their targets with great precision. Their overwhelming technological superiority and the weakness and low morale and reluctance of many of the Iraqi conscripts combined to make the war quick and effective. So American casualties were very low, even though Iraqi casualties were extremely high. As they left Kuwait, the Iraqis set fire to many of the Kuwaiti oil wells and dumped millions of gallons of oil into the Gulf as they fled, which had profound environmental consequences, but no effect upon the outcome of the war itself. The principal highway out of Kuwait was dense with the wreckage of Iraqi trucks and tanks and the bodies of killed Iraqi soldiers. During the war, Iraq had been firing Scud missiles, against Israel, America's ally in the Middle East. They were unaimed, and they weren't particularly effective, except as a terror weapon. They didn't kill anybody inside Israel. But the Americans were very afraid, as the war was going on, that Israel would decide to intervene directly against Iraq, and that in doing so, it would antagonize America's Arab allies in the neighborhood, because the Arabs and the Israelis were themselves traditional enemies. So it was a very tense diplomatic matter to try to keep the Israelis disengaged from the war, from fear that if they weren't, America's fragile alliance in the Middle East would begin to break down. Now, the American media were kept very far from the fighting during the Gulf War, and the army controlled access to the news. They were clearly reacting to one of the lessons they'd learned in Vietnam. You mustn't let the TV cameras film what combat is actually like, because it's so horrifying, and the image of mangled bodies and brutalities committed on both sides are going to have unexpected repercussions. So The great exception to that is that CNN, the cable news people, were actually in Baghdad when the American bombs began falling in the middle of the air raids. That was one of the great news coups of the late 20th century. But once the ground campaign started, the journalists were kept far, far behind the lines of the fighting and could do no more than tell stories about things like seabirds injured by oil pollution, the oil well fires, the morale-building activities behind the lines of the American troops. The fighting itself took place beyond the reach of the TV cameras. Now, President Bush the First, took the momentous decision not to pursue and overthrow Saddam Hussein. Had he done so, clearly he and his forces would very rapidly have been able to occupy Baghdad, the Iraqi capital, and overthrow the dictator. But then what? The American government was still constrained by the Vietnam syndrome, and surely still aware that it would be much easier to get into Iraq than it would be to get out again. And so they decided that, having achieved their principal objective, which was the liberation of Kuwait, they should leave it at that. Later on, Hussein's reassertion of his power in the area, and particularly his use of chemical weapons to poison Kurdish people living inside Iraq's borders, made some American policymakers regret the decision, and the area remained a source of intense political controversy into the 21st century. Now, another thing that was so striking about the Gulf War is that for the first time since World War II, American military leaders became popular heroes at home. General Norman Schwarzkopf quickly got the nickname Stormy Norman. The chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Colin Powell, went on from his success in the war itself to become Secretary of State for Bush's son, George Bush II, when he became president in the year 2000. Meanwhile, the American military undertook studies of its own performance during the war and was generally very pleased by what it discovered. The smart weapons had been built up during the Reagan rearmamentation of the previous decade. And although they hadn't all been quite as smart as they'd hoped, I mean, some of them had clearly gone wrong, nevertheless, they had been effective in keeping American casualties low. There were very few morale problems in the American forces. Discipline had been good, morale had been good. Nothing like the dismaying internal decay of the U.S. Army, which had happened during the Vietnam War. The army itself had been glad when the draft ended because it meant they no longer had to be bringing in reluctant recruits, and America had resumed to the principle of an all-volunteer army in 1973. At first, the level of the recruits had been rather poor, but gradually, as the memory of Vietnam became more distant, the quality of the recruits into the army, particularly in the 80s, had improved, and the army had run a very effective set of TV ads, the Be All You Can Be campaign, which brought in generations of aspiring young men, and increasingly young women too, who could learn careers while serving their country. Let me read to you from a book called The Whirlwind War by Frank Schubert and Teresa Krauss. These are analysts of how the army actually performed in the Persian Gulf War. And they argue that it was a success. Quote, "Some analysts claimed that resumption of the draft would create an army more representative of the total population." That was one of the arguments always for having a draft. Department of Defense spokesman reminded these people that the Army did not want a pool of soldiers that was representative of the general population. The Army did not accept men and women who scored in the lowest third of the Armed Forces qualification test. Such individuals would be both expensive to train and difficult to place in an organization with very few unskilled jobs. No one denied that many young people, black and white, entered the military with career advancement rather than warfare in mind. But no evidence has been found that such soldiers were less ready to fulfill their military obligations when called to do so. On the contrary, the well-educated, highly trained army of the Persian Gulf War consisted of soldiers who were more mature than their cohorts of the past and who had fewer disciplinary problems. Married homeowners with dependent children, they had greater stakes in society and took fewer risks. Research indicates that they made more thoughtful, analytical soldiers who performed exceptionally well under battlefield stress. So, the Army's own conclusion is that their forces had operated in ways entirely appropriate to what they'd hoped. The war itself had brought on scattered protests inside the United States, but nothing remotely to compare with the scale and fury of the anti-Vietnam War protests. And this was partly, perhaps, because the war all took place so quickly. It was too soon for disillusionment to set in, because in the space of a couple of weeks, the whole campaign had been concluded and the result had been a victory. And because it had been a matter of repelling the invader of a tiny kingdom, the moral objectives seemed, the strategic objective and the moral objective seemed clearer. The next great foreign policy dilemma confronting the United States arose in southeastern Europe, and a little bit later in East Africa too. And then, as the decade continued, in the form of transnational terrorism. Let's look first of all at southeastern Europe. What happened there was that this is an area which had been riven by warfare, literally, for centuries. And although the arrival of communism had temporarily put a repressive lid on the situation, as soon as the lid lifted, the old ethnic and religious antagonisms resumed, and the area, the former Yugoslavia, became a boiling point of intense hatreds. Serbs, Croatians, Albanians, Bosnians, Slovenians, Montenegrins, Macedonians. This was an area where there are dozens of competing ethnic groups and which didn't correspond with the actual territory. In other words, in some parts the Muslims would be a majority, in some parts a minority, in some places the Orthodox Christians, in other places the Catholic Christians. A very, very complicated jigsaw of mixed and mutually antagonistic groups. Tito, the Yugoslav dictator, had been a powerful and repressive leader. Without him, the nation began to degenerate into opportunistic warfare. And particularly, the most horrifying aspect of it was what was called ethnic cleansing. That is, local majorities trying to exterminate members of the local minority to create a situation in which there would be an ethnic unity in a given area. I think it's important, actually, to bear in mind what was happening there and compare it with what was happening in America itself. Because, as I've said at various times through the course, America is also a multi-ethnic, multi-religious nation, but has been incredibly successful at assimilating each new generation of immigrants and enabling the Christians and the Muslims and the Jews all the different ethnic groups to live harmoniously side by side. You've only got to take a brief glance at southeastern Europe in the 1990s to see how that isn't something which you can take for granted. It's a great historic achievement which America had managed to accomplish and Yugoslavia had not. That's why it's always so important when you're comparing America with other parts of the world to think about, to compare America with actual alternatives in the world rather than with American ideals about things, about how things could be even better. Aspire to the ideals, but take seriously the achievements you already have. Well, NATO, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, the United Nations, and the United States all attempted to stop the bloodshed, but none of them wanted to become overcommitted in the region, because this again was an area where there was no apparent what was called an exit strategy. You can certainly get in and perhaps stop certain particular atrocities from taking place, but then what? Because nobody was willing to colonize the area permanently and make it into a new form of empire, which was itself politically intolerable for historical reasons, the danger was that any group which went in there would simply become another contender among the rival forces in the area. And once again, the shadow of Vietnam was very evident. There was no clear target or objective for armed forces that intervened. And there was a profound reluctance to be thought imperialist. So there were strong human rights grounds for intervening, but strong political reasons for not intervening. And each argument could be made very, very persuasively, and in fact was made very persuasively. Politicians inside America, like Pat Buchanan, said, "Now that the Cold War has ended, it's entirely appropriate for us to withdraw to our traditional policy of isolationism. We can certainly deplore what's happening in other parts of the world, but we're not powerful enough to intervene in all of them to stop them. Therefore, we must be content ourselves with providing a moral example rather than trying to get involved directly." Equally horrifying was intertribal genocide in Rwanda in East Africa. And that too drew no really effective American response. The long heritage of European colonialism there made intervention in Africa particularly difficult. And the area was less strategically significant than Europe or the Middle East. So in the 1990s, American policymakers faced the possibility of intervening in many parts of the world. There were always good arguments for doing so, and always good arguments for not doing so. They were damned if they did, and damned if they didn't. In addition to those problems, anti-American terrorism created a new undercurrent of anxiety through the 90s and into the new millennium. Ever since the 1960s, political groups fighting usually Liberation Front organizations had realized the effectiveness of hijacking aircraft for purposes of political leverage and publicity for their causes. And so hijacking, it had gone on sporadically all through this period. Usually the response to hijacking was to encourage the people on the plane to take no action in the hope that the plane would be landed and eventually negotiations would lead to the release of the hostages. And quite often that did in fact happen. In February 1993, there was a bombing attack upon the World Trade Center in New York, an attack which killed six people and injured another 1,000 of them. This attack was undertaken by Islamic fundamentalists, who saw the World Trade Center as representative of all that was worst about America. It's what they thought of as its wicked domination and commercial reach over the whole of the rest of the world. The men arrested and convicted of the bombing expressed no remorse for having killed the people, and they declared that their attack had been the will of Allah. So there in the courtroom was a stark confrontation of two very different civilizations, with the bombers clearly being pleased at the destruction they'd wrought. They were sentenced to 240 years in jail. One of their words for America was the Great Satan. And this is a phrase which was first heard in the Iranian Revolution back in 1980 and cropped up periodically in the rhetoric of Islamic fundamentalists. And the American immigrant writer Dinesh D'Souza has this insight in his book What's So Great About America, in which he describes America's achievement at assimilating new generations of people. He says, in a way, it's true that America is the great Satan, because Satan is a tempter, and America is full of temptations. It's an oddly shrewd remark. But he says the superiority of America comes from the fact that in America, although you're tempted, at least you have the freedom and the opportunity to choose to be virtuous. It doesn't mean that everybody will make the right choice, but at least you have the opportunity to choose. Whereas in Islamic regimes, you're not given the choice at all. You're forced to do the right thing. And of course, once you're forced, there's no virtue in it. It's simply a matter of reaction to coercion. A much more lethal event was the work of a homegrown terrorist called Timothy McVeigh, who bombed the federal government's building in Oklahoma City in 1995, a homemade bomb truck. He belonged to a group of Americans called survivalists, people bitterly opposed to the reach and extent of the federal government, and who regarded the government as itself as being at war with the American people. He'd witnessed an incident in 1993 in Waco, Texas, when a small religious group called the Branch Davidians had their compound overrun by the government's armored vehicles. The compound had been set fire, and about 70 members of the religious group had been killed inside. And McVeigh gave that as an example of the tyrannical conduct of the federal government, which he was now dedicated to doing all he could to prevent. Well, of course, his was an extreme view and his terrorist act an isolated one, but it demonstrated that within the population there were significant groups of people completely alienated from the mainstream view of America as a relatively benign nation. The threat of terrorism was immensely costly in time and money and security. It meant, for example, that at airports, every passenger had to have his or her person and his or her luggage very carefully checked. Security business was one of the great thriving growth industries of the 1990s, because nobody could be quite sure where the next attack would come from. And there was always the knowledge that if the terrorists are sufficiently resolute, particularly if they're determined to lay down their own lives on behalf of their cause, it's going to be virtually impossible to stop them. And that knowledge was borne out in the most horrifying form on September the 11th, 2001, when the hijackers flew captured planes, hostage planes, into the World Trade Center itself, finally destroying it altogether. So ironically, America after the Cold War was far safer than it had been before overall, because the threat of global nuclear war had gone away. But although it was safer, it didn't feel safer. Soviet repression had kept the lid on. And now suddenly, wars seemed to be springing up in many different parts of the world. But even more vexing, enemies were harder to identify because they no longer always correlated directly with nation states. Sometimes they were covert organizations, and in the case of McVeigh, organizations of American citizens themselves. Still, the general picture is nevertheless a bright one. The United States remained the one unquestioned superpower. And everything the Americans did mattered. It mattered if the Americans did act, and it mattered if they decided not to. It had profound impact on the rest of the world. Something that not all Americans realized was that America itself had an immense cultural radiance around the world. Millions of people wanted to get into America, wanted to immigrate to this country. And even those who had no opportunity to do that loved American things, the music, the films, the cultural way of life. There was a constant, a fervent enthusiasm for the products of American culture, which showed that even in places which at first glance looked as though they were alienated from America, nevertheless there was an attraction as well as a repulsion there. And that's one piece of testimony to the advantages which America clearly had to offer to the rest of the world.